5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hey, welcome back to Two Mics, Dr. Michael Scheuer and Colonel Mike. And before we get to today's guest, which we're really excited to have on because he has a great story. He's an author just like Mike is. And don't forget EMP Shield, EMP Shield, ourgoldguy.com. And hey, maybe you're worth $28,000 per employee. So go look at the website, Two Mics, TWOMics.us. And we'll have a little jingle in the beginning of the intro for you guys for Christmas. And we want to thank everybody around the globe again, keeping the numbers up. Comments, always welcome. Emails, always welcome. Again, Saudi Arabia, thank you for listening. Number 28 on Apple, Mike, this week. Saudi Arabia, thank you. Mike has the check. The money's in escrow. MBS, anytime you want to sell the oil, just send it down to Newport News. We'll be waiting. Mike has the check, and he has monopoly money, too. So if you want to just send us the oil, America would appreciate it. Don't worry about Democrats and Republicans. When it comes to energy, we're nonpartisan. Okay, let's go right to it. On the screen, let's see where he is. Dr. Canizero, where are you? Canizero, where are you?
I should be there someplace,
there
right?
There you go. All righty, fine. So there he is, author, PhD, Dr. Michael Canizero. Mm-hmm. And we want to welcome him to Two Mics. First time on Two Mics. Has a great book on. It's called The Evil Eye and the Beautiful Heart.
The Pure Heart. The Evil Eye, the Pure Heart.
Pure Heart. All right, sir. Why don't you tell us a little bit of your background? You're from the Bronx, New York. And as you know, we all have the same accent, like Trump.
Well, it's a funny story. When I was a kid, my Italian uncles used to say that I reminded them of Bugs Bunny. And so you would think maybe they would nickname me Bugs, but instead they nicknamed me Doc, which was kind of prophetic because I became the first in the family to get a PhD, PhD in clinical psychology. But in any event, they called me Doc because Bugs Bunny was always saying, "What's up, Doc? What's up, Doc?" So that's how they would greet me. And it was kind of an interesting thing. And now all my buddies, my patients used to call me Doc. Everybody calls me Doc. So we got a couple of Docs here today. Paradox, huh?
Yeah, we have the three mics and two dots.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Pelham Bay section of the Bronx. And both of my ancestors, my father's side, my mother's side, had come from Basilicata, the southern part of Italy. My parents on my mother's side, my grandparents, they came from a small town called Primatico. And it was one of these places that was extremely poor. In fact, my grandmother used to tell stories that before coming to America, they had so little food, they would scrape the plaster off the side of the buildings to mix it in with the dough to make the bread last longer. How's that?
Wow.
That's pretty poor, huh?
It is. Well, you know, there's a lot of people that came from that country back in those days in the late 1890s, you know, super peasant poverty, right? And we talk about, you know, people that get triggered in America and they've had a good life for the last 3-4 generations, but people get crazy. But so, and that's what was that city called again?
In Primatico.
Never heard of it. Never heard of it.
Yeah. It's a tiny little place. It's one of those villages in southern Italy where the people were like, they called them the Stasi people that lived in the caves. And as a matter of fact, my mother used to say to me, "I never want you to visit our hometown. We were so poor, we lived in caves." When in fact, the Stasi style of living was a way of living where the people did have a common room etched out of the stone in the side of the mountains there. But they would all get together in the evenings to cook the meals outside. And it was a different way of life, but certainly not a very healthy one. And I think the Italian government, the Spanish government as well, had some of these people. They put an end to that in the 1950s, but it went on a long time. But my mother felt that they were so poor that she just didn't want us to ever go back and see what she came from. So I have been to Italy now 8 or 9 times. Most recently this past summer, I had a bunch of friends join me in a villa in Umbria, and we did some nice touring, and it was just lovely. But they came from poverty, and my mom didn't want to, you know, have us take a look and see where she came from. But eventually she relented and we went back and met some relatives. And it's just a fascinating thing to go back to the old country and see where they came from and how hard life was for them.
So you're first generation, huh?
I'm one and a half. My father was born in America. His father came over. This is interesting, too. His father came over in 1890 and went out to California. And out in California, he married, had a wife and a couple of kids. The wife and children died of the Russian flu out there. And then he came back to New York. But in 1890s, when the Italians came to America, most of them settled on the West Coast. There were more in California and on the West Coast than there were in New York. And it wasn't until the turn of the century that New York became much more populated with Italian immigrants.
What do you think it was, Mike, that they went to the West Coast? Was it the weather closer to
Southern? It was a lot of the weather, but it was also more welcoming of Catholics. As you know, Father Junipero Serra was out there in California, and there were Catholics in California. There weren't very many in New York, and that was a different situation for them. But there were a lot of opportunities for them to work in the vineyards, of course, the Italians and wine, you know. And for Sicilians, there was the fishing on that side of the country. So there were more opportunities and a little less prejudice out on the West Coast than there was on the East. You know, we were battling nativists on the East Coast here, where the Know-Nothing Party had been rampant in the 1860s and 70s, or actually a little sooner than that, the 1850s. And, you know, some of that carried on, and the anti-Italian, anti-Catholic mentality of Protestant America, you know, from 1890s on and so on, was pretty terrible, pretty difficult. So they didn't make it easy for Italians in New York. No.
Yeah, I witnessed some of that early in the 50s when I was a young guy. Back in the 50s, there was a lot of prejudice even back then.
Oh, yeah.
Against American kids who were like first or second generation from Italian. I never used the Italian American thing. I'm an American of Italian descent. I know everybody likes using the hyphen. Yeah. But, you know, personally, I just think I say, hey, I'm an American. Where are you from? Well, I'm from my mother. You know, no, I mean, where were you born? I was born in a hospital. What else you want to know? You know, I love when they say, oh, I like your accent. Yeah, well, I'm from Milwaukee. Does it sound familiar? You know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like when Trump was the president, you know, with all the slams on Trump, the way he speaks, you know, China and so on. Look, it's just part of the New York culture. Mike is from Buffalo. Yeah. Mike is from Buffalo, and he's pretty close to Italians. He worked in Italian restaurants, cleaning dishes too, right, Mike?
Plenty of dishes.
Yeah.
Plenty
of dishes. I'll tell you another thing that just comes to mind as we're talking, that the Italians, when they came here, were often not permitted to attend the mass in the main part of the churches, the Irish and the German churches. They had to go down to the basement because there was a suspicion that the Italian had these rituals that weren't exactly Catholic. And so there was a lot of prejudice in that regard as well. So that what happened to Mount Carmel Church that you spoke of earlier was that the Italians finally, you know, got money from amongst themselves and built their own churches. And they became the Italian churches. Mount Carmel was famous for its processions and, you know, being a place where the social societies there were a lot of Italian-American societies that would help people find work and so on. And they worked closely with the church to find money for people who couldn't afford bread, and they helped out quite a bit, the social clubs and the Catholic Church, particularly the Italian Catholic churches.
Hey, this is Colonel Mike here for Two Mics. We're getting the shows up as soon as possible. And you just go to networkradio.us and you see the all the shows that we have going up. And as soon as we finish a show, what we do is we send it over to the producers, and then the producers will send it over to networkradio.us. It'll be up there first. And eventually they'll be on the other platforms. So, you know, we always say, people email, hey, where do we go? Where do we, you know, we're all over the web. You can Google us. It's Two Mics. But you have to do Two Mics, Colonel Mike, Dr. Mike. There's a couple of other shows on the web, Two Mic shows. So remember, it's networkradio.us up there first. Hey, don't forget to subscribe wherever we are also. This way you get the notifications. You could do that right on Network Radio. And as soon as they're up, you'll get the fresh show. And again, thanks, Bob.
Yeah, before everybody became a government grifter, yeah, there was actually societies that helped people in in ethnic pocket communities. Yeah, I remember that as a young kid too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember these social clubs were, you know, when you came home from the military, either the Democratic Party Club or the social mm-hmm. club was a place that you went to get the first job or second job. You know?
Yes.
And you got placed, and it was because of at that time. I think at that time, even the 60s, that the Italian community was very closely aligned to the Democrats. And the Democrats were, you got to give them the credit, Mike. The Democrats were the people that called up, whether it was Bell Telephone or Brooklyn Union Gas Company or Con Edison in New York. You know, you were ahead of the line because you got home with an honorable discharge and you needed a job. You know, even the bus company that back at the time, New York City Bus and trains, if you went to those social clubs or you went to the Democratic Club, you were placed really quickly, you know. So it was a different time. Dr. Mike, you want to go?
Yeah, I just find this really fascinating because I lived in, as Colonel Mike said, I lived in Buffalo, and there were very definite parts of the city. One was Italian, a couple were Polish, German, and you know, there was some animosities and some problems, but in the 60s and 70s, there wasn't a lot of, I think we had outgrown a lot of that. And I think what happened too was Catholics have always been so necessary. It's been necessary for Catholics to prove they're kind of ultra Americans.
Right.
And I think that gave a unity to people that otherwise were tended to be rivals, or at least not eager to cooperate with each other or celebrate with each other. Mm-hmm. So I think the church played a big role in getting people together.
Yeah,
I worked for Union Carbide before I came down to Virginia, and we had Irish and almost every European ethnic group, and then blacks too. And I was always surprised by the lack of animosity between people, working people. And it's all gone to hell.
I think it changed a lot after World War II.
I think that's right, sir.
I think that's really where the melting pot took place when, you know, all of these children of immigrants went off to fight for this country. We came back Americans. We didn't come back, you know, Italians or Germans or Irish, et cetera. We came back Americans. And I think that was really the impetus for major change. Although traces of it, now I'm 76 years old. I was studying to be a Catholic priest. You know, that was a tradition in Italian.
Yeah, right. Everybody had to be an altar boy or a priest somewhere, right?
So I went, you know, to the Catholic schools and all that. But I was studying for the Archdiocese of New York, and there was no question that there was a prejudice, even within the seminary, against the Italian boys that were there. And this is the 1960s. And, you know, I was invited out with my fellow seminarians when we had a break, and they would say, well, we're bringing our token guinea with us. How's that for, you know, and for to drink some beers.
Yeah, the Guinea and the WAP. Well, Guinea was more East Coast. WAP was a little bit Midwest. Yeah. Remember that? And Dago. Yeah. Dago was like Cleveland. Dago.
My grandfather told the story. He had an interest in my father's father. This is the one that settled in California and then came to New York. He was trained as a fresco painter. He would do you know, the frescoes in the churches in Italy. Mm-hmm. He came here, and there was no work for him. He wasn't an established artist. So what did he become? He became a wall dog. I don't know if you know what a wall dog is, but these were the guys that painted commercials on the side of buildings, brick buildings. You know, you'd
see Coca-Cola. Yes.
And it's similar to what making a fresco was like, in that you had to, you know, go on and put a layer of plaster on, and then beyond that, trace this this picture that you were going to draw and then paint it. But these fellas, these wall dogs, they had to be part acrobats. They would hang down on a rope with cans of paint around their waist. And they would swing back and forth, and crowds would be down below cheering them on. And, you know, then they would work on scaffolds, et cetera. He actually fell off a scaffold from a six-story building and broke his leg. He was lucky he didn't die. Yeah. And that ended his career as a wall dog. They were called wall dogs because they were painting on walls, and they were sort of leashed by this rope. So like a dog, you know, so... But when he broke his leg, he then became one of the fellows that put the mosaics up in the subways.
Nice, nice.
And so while he's taking a break one of these days, and, you know, he's with his fellow Italians, their feet are hanging over the trench where the subway rails are going to go. An Irish cop comes down and says, "Are you guys all Dago Wops?" And, of course, my grandfather, being a pretty tough guy himself, says, "Yeah, so..." And he said, "Well, go home, you know, Dago Wops. Go back to Italy. Stop taking money out of America and taking it back to Italy with you." And then he kicks my grandfather's lunch into the trench there. My grandfather must have told me that story about a dozen times. And every time he told it, the tears would just pour out of him, that this is how hated we were. And
yeah,
it was an interesting time, very interesting time.
I think
that's the 1910, 1920s times, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But I think every group went, you know, through that, or up the ladder, or down the ladder, however you want to call it.
Yeah.
But we survived. And look,
yes,
you know,
we did.
Hey, look where I am. Look where Mike is. You know, and I use the word trigger a lot, but we don't get triggered. You know, we just remember the stories. So let's go right into the book now, Doc.
Yeah. The book is written, the first book, I'm actually just finishing one on my father's side of the family. The first one is called The Evil Eye, The Pure Heart. And I wrote it so that my children and grandchildren would have something that, you know, that they could remember what hardship people had to go through to get them to where they are at this point in their lives. And so I really wrote it for... you know, something that they would be able to say, you know, I owe my past generations a bit. But this is the story of my mother's side of the family. My mother's mother came to America by herself as a 16-year-old girl in 1897. She came because her father, her mother had passed away when she was about 8 or 9 years old. Her father remarried with my grandmother used to call her the wicked witch. And she didn't get along with my mother, with my grandmother. So my grandfather said, you know, it would be better if you left and went to America. And so she comes here all by herself as a 16-year-old girl. She works in the factories. She gets a job. She lives in a tenement with some relatives. She's making shirts. And she meets my grandfather, who had come a year after my grandmother. He's a couple of years older. They married in New York City. When she got pregnant with their first child, he said, "America is no place for us to raise a family. You're going back to Italy to have the baby. And, you know, when I make enough money, I'll send for you. And then when we can live more appropriately, then, you know, you'll come back here." What happened was that my grandmother has the baby in Italy and sends my grandfather a lock of the baby's hair, my Uncle Michael. And my grandfather then decides he's going back to Italy and he's never coming back to America. Well, that's not what my grandmother wanted. She always wanted to get out of Italy. And so years go by and he can't be persuaded to come. And they're having child after child. They had 8 more kids.
Wow.
When my uncle Michael is about 16, my grandfather was a bully. There's no question about it. He was, I think, an alcoholic by today's standards. He was a wine merchant and he drank his share of the wine. And so what happens is that he becomes abusive. And he did it quite frequently, actually, verbally and physically abusive to my grandmother. And my uncle Michael, now a 16, 17-year-old boy, stands up to him, breaks a chair over his head when he's attacking my grandmother. And my grandfather goes to get his rifle to kill my uncle. So he skedaddles out of the house. And then as time passes within, there's a reconciliation. My grandmother says to my grandfather, "I'm going to America with or without you." And she sends my uncle Michael back first. And then it became this, chain migration, if you want to call it that. He's here. The next children come. Reconciliation with my grandfather. And by 1922, when my mother's 7 years old, she comes to America. My mother tells the story that as they're getting on the ship leaving Naples, my grandmother turned around and spit on the shores and said, "I hope I never come back to this godforsaken country again." So she was pretty happy to get out of here. In the course of their coming to America, my mother tells the story of how my grandmother was afraid of a woman who had funny eyes, thinking that she had malocchia. That's where the concept of the evil eye comes from. It's an old, by the way, that goes back to Mesopotamian times, the evil eye. Right. But It was very, anyway, so, I tell the story of malocchia and my grandmother's fear that she's going to put a curse on the baby that she's holding, my Uncle Charlie. And as what happens is that when my mother is on the ship, they talk about this idea that they don't have enough food, but they will provide food for the children. They'll give extra food to the children. So my mother tells a story of how generous my grandmother was. And she sees an old lady who's literally starving on the boat. And she says to my mother's 7 years old, she says, "You're hungry, aren't you?" My mother says, "No, I'm not." She says, "Yes, you are. Go get some food, some soup. And if you really aren't hungry, you shouldn't waste this soup, should you?" So my mother says, "Of course not." So she said, "So then don't you think you should give it to someone like that little old lady over there?" That was my grandmother. She was always looking out for other people, always helping other people. She's just a wonderful, generous individual. They get here and there's a whole thing about seeing the Statue of Liberty and how my grandfather, I don't know if you're aware of this, but back in the 1920s, people would come out to the the steamship and they would come out in boats and they would be yelling up to their families on the decks there, "Come, I've got bananas for you," my grandfather used to say. And so they go through immigration and my mother's sister, she's about 9 years old, has a fever sore on her lip. And because of the fever sore, she's quarantined. And not only is she quarantined, she's put in the children's bay of the hospital. And then the others that are with her, my grandmother and two of the other kids, what happens is that they have to stay there till she's healed enough to leave Ellis Island. But my grandfather is allowed to come visit. And when he sees her, his daughter with the fever sore, he rips the scab off the fever sore, which only made her stay that much longer. But one of the things I learned in doing research for this book is there were a lot of children that were literally abandoned on Ellis Island. I didn't know if you knew that.
No.
Their parents were either sent back to Italy and they were left in the hospitals, or some cases they were allowed to go to New York and the kids were left in the hospital. They never came and claimed them. So there was a pretty interesting issue with orphans in Ellis Island as well. So, wow. They get here. And by this time, my uncle Michael, the first one who came here, has gotten into the ice business. So all the Italians from the region of Basilicata in the south, they became icemen. And eventually they would be the guys that got into produce and meat, because as icemen, they would deliver to these stores where there were vegetables that needed ice, or meats that needed ice. And eventually they would make a connection and wind up buying produce and meat stores. So that's where my mother's brothers became guys that owned their own stores. They were very ambitious people. You know, they got ahead. And like I said before, I think what my story is all about is just how difficult not only was it in Italy, where there was such a such poverty. And you know, when the Bourbon kings ruled the kingdom of the two Sicilies, they didn't care very much about educating the populace because they were afraid of revolution. Whereas the north, you know, Rome and Piedmont and those places up there, they were more educated people. The people from that area of the country went through the Renaissance and got culture and refinement. And the Northerners hated the Southern Italians, and they wanted to keep them poor. They taxed them. You know, one of the interesting things that I discovered was we have expressions like, you know, don't go against the family. You can only trust family, that sort of thing. The idea was that the Northerners would tax the Southerners once the country became unified. They were taxing them very unfairly. And if word got out that you had a new goat or you were building a new house, you would be taxed for it. So you never said anything. The walls have ears. Don't tell anybody. Right. You got a goat. Yeah. Don't tell anybody. You know, so that was that became. And unfortunately, in terms of assimilating to the American culture, because they were so suspicious, as the Southern Italians and the Sicilians were so suspicious of authority and being unfairly treated, they kept to themselves. So they didn't go to banks for mortgages. They went to uncles and aunts and so on, that sort of thing. So the assimilation of Italians into the American culture was slowed up by their notion of family and not going outside the family for help or assistance. And again, the social clubs we talked about, good on the one hand, but on the other hand, limiting the amount of interaction we had with the larger society. So you only bought food in Italian stores and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, it's funny you use the expression getting ahead.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, back in the day, that was an expression. And, you know, to the listeners, you know, to our podcast, it basically means just going up the ladder. You know, getting ahead in that society was you either got an education, you found a good job, you became a business person, you owned a business, you know.
It was a very interesting thing about education. You know, the Italians from Southern Italy and Sicily were suspicious of people who had educations. Mm-hmm. It was suspicious because they would only wind up, you know, they saw them when they would tell them, you know, you owe us more money, that kind of thing. So they had a kind of a suspiciousness of education. And when they came to America, they felt that the American school system was going to, make the children less Italian, meaning that they were teaching them, how to properly brush your teeth, how to properly clean your fingernails, things like that were going on. But the Italian family, this was like, you're becoming American, you're not Italian any longer. So there was a tendency not to want their children to go to schools. We had very low graduation rates initially in this country because of the fear that fathers would have that you would no longer respect me, you would become too Americanized, too modernized.
That had to be taught at home, not in school. Yeah. And it had to be taught by your mother or your father or your grandmother or your grandfather, you know. Now, let me ask you a question, Mike. How long did your grandmother live? You know, how old were you when she passed?
She 56. She passed in 56. I was 10 years old when she passed.
Okay, so you saw her as a young man.
Yeah.
As a boy, really, you know, and you got to hear all the stories then. Hey, yeah. Take the book. Just take the book. Put the picture in the camera here. You just moved the book there. Show us the cover. There we go.
Yeah.
There it is. Evil High, Pure Heart, We're going to put that picture up on the podcast anyway. Great. I like to show the pictures of the books. Dr. Mike, you have any questions?
Yeah, I just think it's, I don't know. I wanted to ask, sir. I know from my own family experience that some kids didn't finish school simply because they also had to work to support the family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was a major influence. I don't want to make it sound like it was all about losing the Italian culture by going to school. But yes, they needed to go to work to help the families out.
Absolutely. Yeah, I thought that was the case. And I just from my own experience, it was still the case when I was in, seventh or eighth grade. People would not, they couldn't drop out completely, but they would be sporadic in their attendance.
Very interesting. This wasn't just Italians. It was most of those immigrant families. You know, I've had people who are non-Italians who've read my book and gotten back to me and said, you know, I'm Jewish, but this could have easily been my story. We went through the same things that, you describe in this book. Yeah.
Well, certainly my grandmother came here from Hungary after the First World War, and she remained in a Hungarian church, in a Hungarian sororities and Hungarian everything for the rest of her life. But she spoke, she spoke very good English.
Yeah.
And, but she hustled all her life. She was a masseuse and she worked until she was well into her 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So those were tough people.
Yes, they were.
They didn't expect all roses every day, you know, and they probably did get discouraged in their inside, but they always kept up the strong face, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a funny thing. I'm a clinical psychologist. I would get these, the people would come to me sometimes and they would, be moaning and groaning over really, I would estimate, you know, minor hardships in life. And I would sometimes say to them, you know what? You come from good stock. You come from people who made a voyage across the sea. And, they had nothing when they came here. And there is a strength in you that you're not in touch with. And it's about time you realize that you're a lot stronger than you're letting yourself be by moaning and groaning. Get off your ass and get to work, you know, and when I say get to work on yourself, get to work on your job, whatever it is. But, you know, recognize that you're a lot stronger. It just seems to me that we're just making it more difficult for people to find their own stamina and strength, that everybody should run to a doctor immediately. And don't get me wrong, I work with drug addicts and alcoholics. That was the bulk of my private practice work. And I have great sympathy for people with those issues or any issues, really. I'm not trying to dissuade people from getting help, but we live in a society right now that it just, we just don't teach people that you're stronger than you think you are.
No, I think that's
I'm glad you brought that up, Mike, because, you know, everybody speaks. I'm talking about Mike, the author. Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can get him on the screen. There he is. Okay. What I'm saying is the way they equate this immigration flow today is that, oh, we've had this forever and we've had, you know, this is the way America. Yeah. Well, we've had diversity and multiculturalism since the Revolutionary mm-hmm. War. You know, we had mercenaries back then, you know, working right. with Washington, right. you know, the French who we hate at times were our best friends and our bankers, you know, yes. during the war against the British. But the difference between then and now is when I try to explain to young people is like in the case of your grandparents, my grandparents, Mike's, they came here to become American, but right. there was no grift. There was no social network where mm-hmm. you walk in. And you get housing, you have a SNAP right. card, EBT cards, you get free this, free that. You know, like you said, you got to get off your ass and go to work. And if it meant shoveling horse shit, playing that's English, right. that's what yeah. you did. You know, yeah. you shovel coal, you clean the streets, you mop whatever peasant job you can get yeah. with a little knowledge of English, you had a job. Today, yeah. coming across the border and your government says, well, hey, give this guy some housing. Look, I have a guy that worked on my house. Okay. And he said, I can't have nothing but cash because I got, you know, my wife is on the dole. He's a Hispanic guy. So I said, what do you mean? He says, well, my wife gets all the benefits. I just claim I don't live there. I said, then I got to pay you cash. This is how you, this is the whole part. This is the way it is. It's upside down, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the difference between then and now. And that's the difference. I guess it went right through. I want to say the 50s or 60s.
But when I was growing up, and again, I was born in 46, but there were three sources of authority in America. You had government, you had the church, and you had school. Mm-hmm. Who respects government today? Who respects the church today? And the school has gone down the shitter. But, you know, it's a very different world right now. The lack of respect for authority, which is, I think, one of the distinguishing things that I felt about, you know, my culture is there was a sense of respect for your elders, for authority. And I don't know that that's present in what's going on today. I don't know that when you see people flooding the borders like that, that there's a respect for authority, that there was a line that you got on to get into the country.
Right.
Yeah.
Not only that you don't trust the authority anymore because they don't deserve to be trusted, but those authorities are also now attacking the authority of parents.
Right.
Which is really the last bastion.
The last bastion of, authority. Right.
Yeah, it's exactly. I think that's right. I was just going to say, my parents got from their mom and dads the same kind of thing you were talking about. If you ever had a little cold or a sniffle, my father would say, you can be just as sick at school as you can be here.
Yeah.
When I was a little bit older and I'd come in a little late at night, my mother would get me up extra early the next morning. And she'd just say, if you can come in late, you can get up early. And that's
they had all those idioms. Those were great idioms.
Yeah.
Dr. Mike, I want to ask you this question now. When you see these commercials, I really laugh. I love commercials, but there's some commercials where you see they're running the DNA, you know, one of these companies where they're promoting a DNA package. And you see this young girl, or young man, and they say, wow, I got my results back and I'm so proud of my culture. And I bust out laughing. You're born and raised here. What is your culture? Your culture is whatever it is here. Right. And they're like, oh, now I could eat this food, or now I could wear my hair this way, or now I could wear this, you know, and they got like whatever the garb is, the garment that they're wearing. And to me, it's like Saturday Night Live comedy. It's like, I just found out you didn't know. Nobody told you were Vietnamese or you were Korean. Come on, look in the mirror. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now I got my culture. If you're born here, you're an American. And then we grew up with great food. You know that.
Yeah.
Being in New York, being Italian, Mike in Buffalo, he worked in Italian restaurants. We grew up with great food and we grew up next to people who had great food too. I mean, when I went to school, we ate in each other's houses. Remember that? Let's say your mother's making this and that guy's mother's making that. You're like, okay, I'm not going to eat tonight. Boom. And you went over that guy's house, right? And people came to your house. So you would have pot roast. You would have meatloaf. You would have a veal color parmesan, whatever, right? Everybody would go to each other's houses in those days. Today, people are petrified. They're on kids are on iPads. They don't even talk to their parents. You go to a house today and you see people eating. If they're under 50 or about 55, everybody's on an iPad while they're having dinner.
When I was working with parents as a therapist, I would say to them, the first thing I want you to do, because you're complaining about your kid being undisciplined, is take all of the electrical appliances out of their bedroom. And when you give them a timeout, do not send them to the room where they can play with their iPads.
Right.
Send them to the bathroom for their timeout. You know, let it be something that hurts. How big a sense of punishment is it to be sent to your room where you can play with your iPads and your computer and all that?
There's no social interaction like years ago. Like we grew up, you know, with our parents, and if you had I never got to see any of my grandparents. Just one, three of them were already dead. But I mean, if you grew up with your grandparents, you had fun. And you remember, Mike, back in the day, when some parents would say, hey, make sure you go outside, you speak American only. Remember that?
Yeah. They didn't,
You were not allowed to speak Italian outside the house.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. My, I think that's one of the things that in both of my the sides of the family, my father's and my mother's, was a very important distinction from some of their neighbors, in that they both really prized education. And, you know, that was a very important thing. And again, like I was saying, as I was saying before, you know, not every Italian family wanted the kids to go to school. But my grandmother, on my mother's side, the one I wrote the book about, she was very adamant, don't speak Italian in the house and you will go to school. You will go to school and you will go to school and be successful.
Hey, Mike Schuer, did they say that in your house?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say it. I didn't want to interrupt. My mother had two sisters and her brother, and they spoke fluent Hungarian. But my grandmother wouldn't let them speak it in the house, and she wanted them to speak English outside the house and inside the house.
Right.
And the only time that you'd hear the Hungarian is when the older ladies wanted to talk about something they didn't want the kids to know.
Yes.
Oh. Yes. Yes. And of course, we didn't know when they were cussing or not until later in life.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike, did you ever encounter this with the Italian families where one spoke one dialect and the other spoke the other dialect, and they're trying to con you that you're not supposed to hear what they're saying, but you could catch one of the dialects, right? You know what they're saying. It's a big secret. Yeah. It's like they don't want them to know, right? So you get one dialect, but you can't get the. And that was the other thing. I took Italian in school.
Mm-hmm.
When I would come home and practice, my mother would say, "Well, this is from the Romans. I have no idea what you're talking about."
Yeah. Well, I think it might have been around 1910 or so where they had the unified Italian. They called it a lingua franca, where everybody in school was taught the same Italian. And now when you go to Italy, it's pretty much, dialect free, you know, find it very much. Some places, Sicily, I think, has a little more of that. But Italy as a whole, as a country, they don't speak the dialects very much anymore.
Did you get up to northern Italy at all when you went? I was up in northern Italy near Switzerland, and they have like this really weird language. It's almost like French, Italian. It's really tricky language. It's almost like a Latin language.
Well, they do. They speak in the area in the Dolomites between Austria and Italy. Those people speak Ladin, Ladin.
Yes.
Which is very much the old Roman Latin. And, they do speak Italian and Austrian, but, they have their own little language there. They're one of the few places left on Earth where people still speak, quote, Latin. Yeah, interesting.
Sure. Now let's just run this by. Now, what did they say in your house? Was it gravy or sauce? We got to do this.
It was always gravy.
Not gravy, right.
Gravy.
I had on
meatballs
our show.
And gravy.
What,
and
one
everything
of
was spaghetti and meatballs, whether we were eating, macaroni, or it was always spaghetti, you know.
Well, you know, now I just saw somebody put a post. I think it was Michael Savage said before there was pasta, it was spaghetti. So I said, no, it wasn't spaghetti. Before it was pasta, it was macaroni.
That's right.
Spaghetti is just a cut of the macaroni, right?
Yeah.
But one of our earliest shows, Mike and I did, we had Senator Manchin on from West Virginia. Mm-hmm. Who's half Italian. And I guess his name is
Mancini. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess his name is Mancini and they cut it short.
Oh, yeah.
The first question I asked him out of the box, Mike, I said, Senator Manchin, what did they say in your house? Was it sauce or was it gravy? Right out of the box, he was like cold cocked, right? He said, of course it was sauce. But if you go to Philly, it's gravy. If you go to New York, it's gravy.
That's
the rest
right.
of the country, it's they gravy. Call it sauce, you know?
Yeah.
Have you been to San Francisco to any of the Italian restaurants in that area?
Yeah, I went a couple of years back. My brother-in-law was living out that way, and we went and had a visit with him. And we did have it's a very old Italian restaurant that we went to. I can't think of the name of it. I know we bought mugs as a memento from it. But yeah, the food was delicious out there.
They had some really, really great restaurants before COVID. I mean, I haven't been there, since COVID, but I remember eating a bowl of the most expensive Chopino I ever ate in my life at the waterfront. I think it was $22 for a bowl of soup. And I looked at the guy and I said, what comes in here? Gold coins? What's happening? You know, just give me an idea.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good food there. Good food.
Yeah. Good food. Yeah, good. And we had great restaurants up in New York years ago. You had restaurants almost every other corner, you know.
Well, my mother was a fabulous cook. My father, it was funny. He used to take clients out and they would say, you know, I've heard your wife is a great cook. Could we eat at your house instead? My mother would always make these wonderful meals. And there was a way of stretching whatever, you know, you had on the table. For some reason, if a guest came, there was still food enough. It was like the miracle of the loaves and the fishes. There was all, it just seemed to multiply. Didn't matter. But, you know, each time he would bring one of his clients over, they would say, can I get you started in a restaurant? This food is delicious. And I was fortunate enough to have a non-Italian wife here that I loved dearly, who, you know, learned from my mother, and she's become a great Italian chef, you know, really fabulous.
Fantastic. And,
so I'm very fortunate. Yeah.
Well, what is your wife's ethnicity? What is she?
My wife's family on her mother's side is Polish, 100% Polish. And on her father's side, it was a mix of Irish and German.
Wow.
There's some wonderful stories. As I've been doing research, her brother has been doing research on his family, and some of the stories that he's telling about what the Irish in his family opening up a saloon in Manhattan and helping out the postal workers to provide them with free meals and so on, and some lovely stories. I mean, when you really get back into, you know, the origins of families that came here, there was some super duper people. I mean, it's just amazing. Her brother tells a story of this saloon owner, Meehan was their last name, being involved with Tammany Hall and so on. They wanted to run him for Congress, I think, at one point. But he, you know, he's a pretty humble guy. And he used to give all the leftover food to, you know, the homeless and bring it to the church and things like that. And, you know, nobody ever knew where the food came from. He would just deliver it. Just wonderful stories about how these people have this generosity of spirit that I hope it's not completely gone, but sometimes I think it's we're losing it.
Yeah, I think we lost big time. Mike, we want to wrap it up and thank you for coming on. You know, we really do appreciate it. We hope you do. How long is the book out? And we hope you do very well with it. You know,
I think I finished it about a year and a half ago, and it's been out now. We did a little marketing campaign in a couple of Italian-American magazines, and we're getting a nice response from it. And as I say, it's just delightful to hear from people, again, not Italian necessarily, saying, this is our family story as well. And I'm, as I said before, I'm finishing my father's father's story, which it's very different in some respects than my mother's. Very different the way that he settled in this country and the just the way things broke for him versus her family. So, yeah.
In your first book, in a time of more common sense and decency, would have been an ideal film in Hollywood.
Well, it's funny. I have a son who runs a production studio in the city. He's made three movies that have been out. And we keep saying, you know, maybe Mike, this is one that, you know, it's not too late to try to make this into a movie. He loves it. And we've given that some talk.
Well, it'd be interesting because if you made it into a movie that followed your story, sir, I think that the moguls out there in Hollywood would be shocked by how many Americans would go and see it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's nice of you to say. From your lips to God's ears, as they say.
Well, we have a big audience in America, and we do have an international audience, and we thank everybody around the globe for tuning in all the time to Two Mics. And hopefully some of our audience will pick up the book, and whether it's on the Kindle or, you know, hard copy, soft copy.
Yeah. If they look up my name, and you know, I've written four novels too. As a clinical psychologist, I put a few very interesting cases that I worked on into a series of what we call the mystical detective stories, where I have a detective who doesn't know he's a seer until the fourth book, and then, you know, solves cases. So the first one, I retell the story of Babe Ruth and his alcoholism and how he was forced by the disease of alcoholism to become a hero child and consequently the greatest hero in baseball. And each of my novels is a part hard-boiled thriller and part a psychological study of an individual. So I've gotten excellent reviews on the novels as well. They're very interesting too.
I'm sure Dr. Michael Wright those in the notes about Babe Ruth. He's another big Yankees fan. He wears his Yankee satin jacket 24 months a year, and there's only.
Then you have to read Conditional Love. You'll love it. Absolutely love it.
Conditional. I will get it today, sir. Yeah. Conditional Love.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Mike, thank you very much. It was great.
My pleasure.
It was our honor to have you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're welcome, fellas.